The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
What I have in mind to talk about today, I have this idea that it would be nice if you followed it with your imagination. Meaning some of the things that I talk about, if you don't just kind of listen to it in terms of ideas or doctrines or things to just understand in a cognitive level, but maybe you can have a reference point in your imagination. Maybe you can visualize some of the things being talked about or find a reference point in your own experience for them. So I think it'll go along, but things probably more interesting that way. And maybe it will, I don't know if I can talk that way, that would evoke that, but that's kind of my wish, partly because what I want to talk about, I think, is deeper than our cognitive ideas. And so, but I want to start with a kind of overarching quote from the Buddha that we'll come back to near the end. And it's a quote that I find personally meaningful. And that is, the Buddha said once that he taught what he taught, he summarized what he taught, and I teach suffering and the end of suffering. I teach about suffering and how to bring suffering to an end. And I think that's a very significant statement about the core principle of what he was about. And in some ways, it doesn't have to be very complicated. It doesn't require a lot of doctrine or a lot of metaphysical ideas or cosmic ideas. It's a this very simple, ordinary human phenomenon of suffering and then coming to an end of it. So that's kind of in the background as I give this talk. Some weeks ago, I gave a talk where I evoked the image of the Buddha we have here in this our statue of the Buddha touching the earth. And I'd like to do that again. And it's a very powerful image, and it's evocative or suggestive, it's symbolic, so it can be applied or in many different ways or interpreted or experienced in many different ways, what it might be pointing to. And it's been used down through the ages as a reference point for teachings. And sometimes there's some very florid, dramatic Buddhist text that describes the circumstance for the Buddha touching the earth. It was supposedly the night of his enlightenment, and there was this semi-deity named Mara, whose seemingly job description is to prevent people from getting enlightened. When Mara got a sense that the Buddha was, you know, on the brink of enlightenment, Mara came along with his all his forces, all his armies and attendants and daughters and everything, in order to throw everything he had at the Buddha to prevent him from being enlightened. So he apparently, you know, there was these dramatic stories of legions of soldiers, of every, you know, it's kind of like the Lord of the Rings kind of thing, you know, these are legions of these all kinds of beings coming and attacking the Buddha with spears and arrows, and Buddha just sits there peacefully under the Bodhi tree, and the arrows and spears and discus and everything being thrown at him all turn into flowers and fall around on his feet, fall around on the ground around him, and he sends all the possible forces of temptation that a person could ever struggle with. He offers Buddha every temptation you can imagine, and nothing moves the Buddha. He sits there peacefully. And but then he comes with his secret weapon, you know, the one that really is going to challenge the Buddha, the one that gets the Buddha to kind of finally, like, I imagine he finally flinched. And he said, "You have no right to be enlightened." So doubt. Then for so many people, doubt is often a huge hindrance. You know, who am I? And am I up to it? Can I do it? Do I deserve it? Do I have a right for it? And the reason I think the Buddha flinched with that point is he didn't just he no longer relied on his own ability to stay calm, non-reactive, and just not get involved with anything, not buy into it or get. But rather, what he did was he leaned forward and touched the earth. And the idea of touching the earth was he was calling upon the earth goddess, to be his witness for his right to be awakened. And at which point the earth shook. And the earthquake that was formed frightened Mara and all the soldiers and temptations away. And the Buddha was left alone to then proceed to his enlightenment. And so this idea of touching the earth, touching nature, and then receiving protection from it, receiving support from it, I think is an image which I find very powerful. And this idea that at the end the Buddha couldn't do it by himself. The conceit of I can do it, I can manage everything, or whatever. But he had to call on something which was larger than himself. Maybe it was still himself, but certainly larger than his small self. He called upon nature or the earth to for support, for witness, to be seen, to be recognized for what he could do. And this reaching, opening oneself up to the wider world, to the natural world, as part of who we are, as part of what can maybe awaken us or open the doors for awakening, I think it's a profound metaphor, symbol, that rather than being closed and rather being caught in ourselves, it's all me, myself, and mine, to open up and to be attentive and aware and connected to the natural world. I might have talked about this recently, but there's not a few people now who are big scholars who are beginning to criticize the secular mindfulness movement, for which the Buddhist mindfulness movement overlaps with, for being excessively individualistic, reinforcing individualistic values of our culture. And so this idea of, you know, going outside of yourself and calling upon something which is larger than yourself or a connection to the natural world, that somehow has a role and a place for this movement towards real inner freedom. And so the Buddha touched the earth, and he touched it with this very, you can see usually these statues, these pictures, it's a very soft, gentle, kind of peaceful, kind of reaching his hand forward to touch. His hands are open, and he's just gently touching it. You know, he's not. You don't want to hurt the earth when you touch it. Just gentle, and very different. You know, if the statues had him having a fist, you know, and he was reaching down with his fist to touch the earth. You know, I don't think that would be as powerful for us. And perhaps coming with what the fist represents, maybe the earth would not have protected the Buddha, wouldn't have offered its support for us. And we know that the way that we live in this world of ours, that we can live in ways that is in harmony with the natural world, and we are tremendously, you know, our whole life depends on being supported by the natural world. And so we can live in harmony with that and continue with that support, and we could also destroy it. And history of the globe of humankind is filled with, you know, for thousands of years have been filled with events where civilizations were destroyed from over-utilizing the resources of their local area. And I grew up in, part of my growing up on the, near the Dalmatian coast of Yugoslavia, what was Yugoslavia when I was growing up, Croatia. And those islands were beautiful, barren rocks. They used to be forested and full of soil. And it was over-farmed, for mostly for grapes, apparently. And so we continue to do it today, this overuse of the, you know, and we destroy the very thing that is supporting us. So how do we touch it? How do we connect to it? The word for mindfulness in Pali is sati. And one of the meanings that the Buddha gave to sati is to remember things that existed long ago. So it's not only about being in the present moment here and now. So when it's our turn to touch the earth. When it's our turn to reach forward and know and call on our planet, our globe, our earth, our natural world around us, what do we reach forward and touch? And one of the values of Buddhism is always both is remember the past in a sense, but also to touch what's here and specifically here and now. So all of you right now happen to be, you have in common, that you're right here in this room, in these two rooms, right here. But where are you? What do you touch when you touch the earth here? Where are we? Is an interesting question. And if we simply say we're in the corner of Birch and Hopkins, that's okay. But are there other ways of touching and knowing where we're at? We are sitting on top of 400 feet of alluvial mud plains. 400 feet of mud underneath us, clay, that's been deposited for the last 4 to maybe 8 million years of soil coming down from the coastal mountains. And as this trough that makes up the Bay Area has been sinking, it's been steadily sinking for these 4 to 8 million years, it gets filled in with all this clay and all this beautiful rich soil. There grew wonderful oak trees. I don't know if you've noticed the big oak trees around here. Beautiful oak trees, the valley oaks. Beautiful trees. And there's also, this, I don't know if it's original to right immediately right here, but close by here, there's beautiful black oaks that are native to just up in the hills here. And coast live oaks. And there should be plains of oaks here, growing here. And they're probably beautiful and ancient oaks, in which there were grizzly bears and elk and deer and rabbits and all kinds of animals here. And then about 10,000 years ago, people seemingly came down from further north in the Canadian Alaska area, and the native, what we call the native indigenous people came down and started to settle here. And we know that in this area here, that people have been settled for about 5,000 years. And one of the very touching places that's a remnant of that is San Bruno Mountain. San Bruno Mountain, at least in contemporary Native Americans who come from this area, consider it to be a sacred mountain. And one of the biggest probably villages that existed in the Bay Area was at the foot of San Bruno Mountain. And on top of these 5,000-year-old shell mounds that were kind of sacred, special mounds. And one of the biggest shell mounds left in the Bay Area is up there on San Bruno Mountain, kind of squeezed between Highway 101 and the steep slope going up. I know there's that really wonderful, strange kind of, I don't know, it looks like an airplane wing kind of shaped building. On the, if you're going north, it's on the left of the freeway. I think it's right around there. So we have this wonderful juxtaposition of 5,000-year-old shell mounds and this modern, tall building there. So you drive up there. And so we've had people living here for a long time, and but it wasn't a very big population of people. People think that between San Mateo and San Francisco, there were about 14,000 Native Americans who lived here, and they lived in apparently 11 different. They were all called the Ohlones nowadays, but within the Ohlones, there were about 11, 12 different tribes, and it seems that where we are here. The tribes were Puichun and Lamchin, the people. And they called this land Yelamu, apparently. We're on the Yelamu land. And and they lived here peacefully. At some point, Sir Francis Drake came here and he named this area here New Albion. And then in the 1750s or so, the Spanish came and they named it Alta California. And they made all kinds of missions up and down the coast, and the Native Americans moved to the missions, were forced to the missions, and many of them died from measles and other illnesses that the Europeans brought with them, and ended up in poverty. And and they had a language that is known as the Rametush. So this is, you know, touching the earth here. This is part of what we're touching, this history. The last person who was fluent in Rametush was a woman named Isabel Meadows, who died in 1939. She died in Washington, D.C., where she was living for 5 years at this kind of helping the Smithsonian Institute to learn all about her people and her language and her stories. And in 1792, after the Spanish had built their missions here, George Vancouver came here to San Francisco. He was an English explorer who came on a ship called Discovery, HMS Discovery. And he then went horseback riding from San Francisco down to San Jose. The way the account is given, he was just basically kind of a tourist, guest of the local Spanish governor when we were part of Spain here. And this is one, probably the first account in English language of Redwood City, or what became Redwood City, this land that we're touching, that we're on top of here. And people think that the creek or the river that he talks about in this little passage is Cordilleras Creek. Cordilleras Creek is the border between Redwood City and San Carlos. So it's, you know, as... But, you know, you wouldn't know it was there anymore unless you go up into the hills and you can see some of it. So he wrote this in 1792. He was then about 34 years old, captain of British exploring trip, boat. At noon, we arrived at a very pleasant and enchanting lawn. At noon, we arrived at a very pleasant and enchanting lawn, situated amidst a grove of trees at the foot of a small hill by which flowed a very fine stream of excellent water. We had not proceeded far from the delightful spot when we entered a country I little expected in these regions. For about 20 miles, it could only be compared to a park, which had originally been closely planted with true English oak. The undergrowth had been cleared away and had left the stately lords of the forest in complete possession of the soil. So the first account of this area, Redwood City, was like an English park with these huge stately oak trees that kind of spotted the area. Probably the Native Americans burned regularly to keep the undergrowth low, and that's part of the reason. He made this trip in the middle of November. So probably the first rains of the year had happened. Things are starting to get green, and it was probably beautiful and nice and wonderful time to see. And so we're on top of alluvial soil deposited over a few million years. The place that had no buildings like we have now, and no freeways and no roads and no sewage things, and huge open plains of oaks. And there was one big piece of property here. About 1795, the governor, the Spanish governor of California, was given 35,000 acres of land between San Mateo County and I think Palo Alto to be his property. And that property was called Rancho de las Pulgas, Flea Ranch. And then when in 1820s or so, when California became part of Mexico, the title of that passed on to his family. And then in 1848, when through circumstances, California became part of the United States, then there was a rumor that was spread around that that the property, this huge estate, the huge ranch, was the owners no longer had the title because it was a Mexican title. So people started squatting on the land. And by this time, there was a woman named Donna Arguello who owned it. And if you go down to the train station, you can see a statue of her there, a bust. And Donna Arguello then hired a man named Simon Meses in 1854, in order to contest these squatters. And Meses won the lawsuit, so that she got the title. But his payment was he was given what's now Redwood City, east of El Camino. And he named it, or it was called, Mesesville. That was the original name of this part of the town. And it's what's left is it's about three blocks from here. There's a little park called Meses Park, named after him. He turned around and sold parts of the property to the squatters. So he made some money, more money, and to other people. Apparently he also sold part of it to the land commissioners who voted in favor of the property rights. So, and they turned around and sold it and made a profit. And so it was divided, and then at some point it was divided to a much smaller property here that went from Whipple, which is one block over, all the way south to Woodside, from El Camino, all the way up into the mountains. And it was owned by Moses Hopkins. And Moses Hopkins was the brother of Mark Hopkins, who was one of the four Pacific Railroad tycoons who built the Transcontinental Railroad. And so I guess that's maybe his, I don't know if that's his house next door here. It's called Morgan's Hopkins Manor. Because what I read is his house was on where the high school is now. And at the 1906 earthquake, the house fell down. And maybe he rebuilt it there, or someone rebuilt it there. And it was cattle. They ran cattle here. And then in 1906, two Japanese brothers started growing chrysanthemums in Redwood City. And by the 1920s, Redwood City was the chrysanthemum capital of the world. So this is a long little story. What does this have to do with freedom and liberation and touching the earth? So that continued to develop and grew, and they were going to build a big naval yard in Redwood Shores, but that didn't work out for the Navy and World War II. And some, any of you here when there was a Marine World used to be in Redwood Shores? So, you know, that was a big amusement area. And then it became kind of a, you know, we came here in 2001, too. It was kind of a working class area. And we came here to be in this building here, which was built in 1950s, early 50s, by a semi-mystical Christian church called First Christian Assembly. And they sold it to Unity, and then they bought it back from Unity. And mostly used to hold it, waiting for someone to come along. And they found us. And when we first met them, when I first met them, I came here first alone. They gave me a tour of this building. And, you know, it's a small building. The tour doesn't take long. And there's all these pews here, lined up here. The stage up there was kind of the main, I don't know what to call it, but that's where the cross was. But there was pews, and we sat down here in the pews with the couple, who the two ministers and myself, and we ended up sitting in silence. And they were a Christian tradition that sat in silence. And we sat in silence, and it was quite a beautiful thing to sit here in this shared silence that we're somehow the continuity of. They wanted us to be the continuity of what they did. And then other people came to, you know, part of IMC, came to see the church. And so we got up to greet them, and I leaned over to the couple, and I said, "Someday we'll have to continue where we left off." So I often think about coming, sitting here in silence, and we're continuing something that was started way before us. And so then Redwood City develops, and the biggest employer in Redwood City is Oracle, which is a big data processing firm. And hospitals are big, second or third biggest employers. Electronic Arts. The city keeps growing and developing. It's getting gentrified. I read recently, this weekend, that the highest rents for studios and one-bedroom apartments in the Bay Area, maybe of the world, is Redwood City. On 400 feet deep alluvial plains where the grizzlies roamed, the Native Americans lived. And wave after wave of different people come to live here. Some people feel the Esalen Indians, Esalen Native Americans, who believe they used to live here. But then the Ohlone came in and pushed them south. The Spanish came in and decimated the Ohlones, and then the Esalens were pushed even further south and went up into the mountains where they survived. And I talked to one of the Esalen natives last summer, who up in the Big Sur Mountains where he lives. And up until when he was still a child or a teen, 1960s, his father would still go into the mountains and would do small burns, 1 or 2 acre burns, and which is what the natives did for generations, to kind of keep the vegetation just right for all the things they needed to do. And the Forest Service came along and said, "You have to stop burning." And then the last couple of years, they're coming back to him and say, "We need you to tell us how to do this. And, you know, and how did you read the terrain? And how did you understand the weather? And, you know, what you did it in the fall? And, how did you do it, that you knew to do it so, you know, well?" And then I read that the Monterey Bay has, at the level of one, just, you know, part of our wider community, and probably true for the Bay Area too, at a certain level deep down, Monterey Bay is about 1,000 feet, there's as much plastic there as at the great plastic garbage patch in the Pacific. The microplastics, microparticles. And George Vancouver talked about the excellent water in Cordilleras Creek. How many of you would go over there to the creek now and drink it? We have a little, kind of a well in our property. It's a shaft, just big white shaft. And we had it tested once, the water, and not to be drunk. So the Esalen removed, the Ohlones decimated, the Spanish came, the United Statesian people came, made it hard for the Spanish who were here, the Mexicans who were here. And the waves of people keep coming. Coming and coming and growing and developing. And that's part of the nature, part of what we're touching here. And some of that should be celebrated, and it's wonderful, and some of it should be cried over and our hearts broken. The earth here has been changed dramatically from the ancient times. Is it really still a natural world, an earth that supports us, that we can touch and feel its protection of us and support of us? Or what is it? What do we have here? So the Buddha said, I teach one thing, or I teach suffering and the end of suffering. He didn't say, I teach personal suffering. I teach about your own little personal life and your suffering and how to be free of your suffering. To me, it's very significant. He said suffering and the end of suffering. Because suffering is not only a personal thing. I think that as we become mindful, as we become connected to this world, so we remember what this world is about, as we look around and we experience lots of suffering in the world. And the end of suffering is not just the end of our own personal suffering, because suffering doesn't end when our personal suffering ends. We live in an ocean of suffering all around us. And so how do we live with, how do we touch the earth? How do we connect? How do we remember? I'm very fond of the word remember, because it means to bring the members back together. So to remember ourselves, to be mindful of ourselves, is to recall and remember, bring back together all of who we are. No part left out. But also to remember, to touch the earth and remember, reconnect, reassemble all of what we are. And we are also the natural world, and we are also the suffering of the world around us. And do we have the capacity, do we have the ability, have we developed the inner freedom, have we developed the care that allows us to sit like the Buddha, with an open chest, an open heart, with a soft hand, a gentle hand that touches the world so gently and caringly, that is inclusive of all that's here in this place, in this time, that's inclusive of the world that we live in, so that our practice of Buddhism is not insulated from where we are, where we sit, so that when we touch the earth, maybe metaphorically, by really waking up and being connected to this place where we are, we understand where we are. We've learned where we are. We learn the history and where we fit in that history and the momentum that we're in, and that we care about it. We're the caretakers of it. But not as a burden, not as an obligation, but rather as the lightness of a heart that feels that there's no separation between ourselves and what's around us. That what's around us is as much ourselves as our own hands and feet and heart and thoughts. And how do you want to treat yourself? How do you treat the world? To treat it with care and love and appreciation, and to be and help contribute to creating a relationship to the natural world So we're in harmony, so the natural world can take care of us. If we don't do that, if we don't care to do that, if we let someone else do that, those people are supposed to do that. Then when it's your turn to reach forward and to touch the earth might not be there for you. So here we sit. This is where we are. And currently, if you're going to give directions to someone, you say that we live on the corner of Birch and Hopkins. But that's pretty, that's just like a teeny, teeny, teeny bit. And to add to teeny, teeny bit of that richness, when our address used to be 1225 Hopkins, but we put the entrance over there, we asked the post office, I think, if we could change our address. And so they said yes. And then they said, here's a range of numbers you could choose. So we chose 108, which is a special number in Buddhism. So here we can tell you all this history. Now it's all here. And you're here, and you're a contributor to that, you're part of that. And I look forward to our ability as a community, as a group of individuals, as part of our society, that all of us together will discover what happens when we touch the earth, this multifaceted, rich world that we're in and feel connected to. I hope that this talk has inspired you to consider that you're part of something much bigger than you ever imagined. And you're part of that flow and history and development and the movement of the natural world. And please live in it well. Live in it with mindfulness and with remembering. And may our suffering maybe contribute to the ending of suffering in all directions. So thank you.